Chapter 54. The Overture. Commencement of the Business. Well-beloved novel readers and gentle patronesses of romance, assuredly it has often occurred to every one of you that the books we delight in have very unsatisfactory conclusions, and end quite prematurely with page 320 of the third volume. At that epoch of the history it is well known that the hero is seldom more than 30 years old, and the heroine by consequence some 7 or 8 years younger, and I would ask any of you whether it is fair to suppose that people after the above age have nothing worthy of note in their lives, and cease to exist as they drive away from St. George's, Hanover Square? You, dear young ladies, who get your knowledge of life from the circulating library, may be led to imagine that, when the marriage business is done, and Amelia is whisked off in the new traveling carriage, by the side of the enraptured Earl, or Belinda, breaking away from the tearful embraces of her excellent mother, dries her own lovely eyes upon the throbbing waistcoat of her bridegroom, you may be apt, I say, to suppose that all is over then. That Amelia and the Earl are going to be happy for the rest of their lives, in his lordship's romantic castle in the north, and Belinda and her young clergyman, to enjoy uninterrupted bliss in their rose-trellised parsonage in the west of England. But some there be among the novel-reading classes old experienced folks who know better than this. Some there be who have been married, and found that they have still something to see and to do, and to suffer mayhap, and that adventures, and pains, and pleasures, and taxes, and sunrises and settings, and the business and joys and griefs of life go on after, as before the nuptial ceremony. Therefore I say, it is an unfair advantage which the novelist takes of hero and heroine, as of his inexperienced reader, to say goodbye to the two former, as soon as ever they are made husband and wife. And I have often wished that additions should be made to all works of fiction which have been brought to abrupt terminations in the manner described, and that we should hear what occurs to the sober married man, as well as to the ardent bachelor, to the matron, as well as to the blushing spinster. And in this respect I admire and would desire to imitate the noble and prolific French author, Alexandre Dumas, who carries his heroes from early youth down to the most venerable old age, and does not let them rest until they are so old that it is full time the poor fellows should get a little peace and quiet. A hero is much too valuable a gentleman to be put upon the retired list in the prime and vigor of his youth, and I wish to know what lady among us would like to be put on the shelf, and thought no longer interesting, because she has a family growing up, and is 4 or 35 years of age. I have known ladies at 60, with hearts as tender, and ideas as romantic as any young misses of 16. Let us have middle-aged novels then, as well as your extremely juvenile legends. Let the young ones be warned that the old folks have a right to be interesting, and that a lady may continue to have a heart, although she is somewhat stouter than she was when a schoolgirl, and a man his feelings, although he gets his hair from Truefitts. Thus I would desire that the biographies of many of our most illustrious personages of romance should be continued by fitting hands, and that they should be heard of until at least a decent age. Look at Mr. James' heroes. They invariably marry young. Look at Mr. Dickens. They disappear from the scene when they are mere chits. I trust these authors, who are still alive, will see the propriety of telling us something more about people in whom we took a considerable interest, and who must be at present strong and hearty, and in the full vigor of health and intellect. And in the tales of the great Sir Walter, may honor be to his name, I am sure there are a number of people who are untimely carried away from us, and of whom we ought to hear more. My dear Rebecca, daughter of Isaac of York, has always, in my mind, been one of these, nor can I ever believe that such a woman, so admirable, so tender, so heroic, so beautiful, could disappear altogether before such another woman as Rowena, that vapid, flaxen-headed creature, who is, in my humble opinion, unworthy of Ivanhoe, and unworthy of her place as heroine. Had both of them got their rights, it ever seemed to me that Rebecca would have had a husband, and Rowena would have gone off to a convent, and shut herself up, where I, for one, would never have taken the trouble of inquiring for her. But after all, she married Ivanhoe. What is to be done? There is no help for it. There it is in black and white at the end of the third volume of Sir Walter Scott's Chronicle, that the couple were joined together in matrimony. And must the disinherited knight, whose blood has been fired by the sons of Palestine, and whose heart has been warmed in the company of the tender and beautiful Rebecca, sit down contented for life by the side of such a frigid piece of propriety as that icy, faultless, prim, niminy-piminy Rowena? Forbid it fate, forbid it poetical justice. There is a simple plan for setting matters right, and giving all parties their due, which is here submitted to the novel reader. Ivanhoe's history must have had a continuation, and it is this which ensues. I may be wrong in some particulars of the narrative, as what writer will not be, but of the main incidents of the history, I have in my own mind no sort of doubt, and confidently submit them to that generous public which likes to see virtue righted, true love rewarded, and the brilliant fairy descend out of the blazing chariot at the end of the pantomime, and make Harlequin and Columban happy. What, if reality be not so, gentlemen and ladies, and if, after dancing a variety of jigs and antics, and jumping in, and out of endless trapdoors and windows, through life's shifting scenes, no fairy comes down to make you as comfortable at the close of the performance? Ah! Let us give our honest novel folks the benefit of their position, and not be envious of their good luck. No person who has read the preceding volumes of this history, as the famous chronicler of Abbotsford has recorded them, can doubt for a moment what was the result of the marriage between Sir Wilfrid of Ivanhoe and Lady Rowena. Those who have marked her conduct during her maidenhood, her distinguished politeness, her spotless modesty of demeanor, her unalterable coolness under all circumstances, and her lofty and gentlewoman-like bearing, must be sure that her married conduct would equal her spinster behavior, and that Rowena the wife would be a pattern of correctness for all the matrons of England. Such was the fact. For miles around Rotherwood her character for piety was known. Her castle was a rendezvous for all the clergy and monks of the district, whom she fed with the richest viands, while she pinched herself upon pulse and water. There was not an invalid in the three writings, Saxon or Norman, but the palfrey of the Lady Rowena might be seen journeying to his door, in company with Father Glauber, her almoner, and Brother Thomas of Epsom, her leech. She lighted up all the churches in Yorkshire with wax candles, the offerings of her piety. The bells of her chapel began to ring at 2 o'clock in the morning, and all the domestics of Rotherwood were called upon to attend at matins, at complines, at nones, at vespers, and at sermon. I need not say that fasting was observed with all the rigors of the church, and that those of the servants of the Lady Rowena were looked upon with most favor whose hair shirts were the roughest, and who flagellated themselves with the most becoming perseverance. Whether it was that this discipline cleared poor Wamba's wits, or cooled his humor, it is certain that he became the most melancholy fool in England, and if ever he ventured upon a pun to the shuddering poor servitors, who were mumbling their dry crusts below the salt, it was such a faint and stale joke that nobody dared to laugh at the innuendos of the unfortunate wag, and a sickly smile was the best applause he could muster. Once, indeed, when Guffo, the goose boy, a half-witted poor wretch, laughed outright at a lamentably stale pun which Wamba palmed upon him at supper time, it was dark, and the torches being brought in, Wamba said, "Guffo, they can't see their way in the argument, and are going to throw a little light upon the subject." The Lady Rowena, being disturbed in a theological controversy with Father Willibald, afterwards canonized as St. Willibald, of Barristers, Hermit and Confessor, called out to know what was the cause of the unseemly interruption, and Guffo and Wamba being pointed out as the culprits, ordered them straightway into the courtyard, and 3 dozen to be administered to each of them. I got you out of front the Beale's castle, said poor Wamba, piteously, appealing to Sir Wilfred of Ivanhoe, and canst thou not save me from the lash?
Yes, from front the Beale's castle, where you were locked up with the Jewess in the tower, said Rowena, haughtily replying to the timid appeal of her husband.
Earth, give him 4 dozen. And this was all poor Wamba got by applying for the mediation of his master. In fact, Rowena knew her own dignity so well as a princess of the royal blood of England, that Sir Wilfred of Ivanhoe, her consort, could scarcely call his life his own, and was made, in all things, to feel the inferiority of his station. And which of us is there acquainted with the sex, that has not remarked this propensity in lovely women, and how often the wisest in the council are made to be as fools that are bored, and the boldest in the battlefield are craven when facing her distaff? Where you were locked up with the Jewess in the tower, was a remark too, of which Wilfred keenly felt, and perhaps the reader will understand, the significancy. When the daughter of Isaac of York brought her diamonds and rubies the poor gentle victim, and, meekly laying them at the feet of the conquering Rowena, departed into foreign lands to tend the sick of her people, and to brood over the bootless passion which consumed her own pure heart, one would have thought that the heart of the royal lady would have melted before such beauty and humility, and that she would have been generous in the moment of her victory. But did you ever know a right-minded woman pardon another for being handsome, and more love-worthy than herself? The Lady Rowena did certainly say with mighty magnanimity to the Jewish maiden, come and live with me as a sister, as the former part of this history shows. But Rebecca knew in her heart that her ladyship's proposition was what is called bosh in that noble Eastern language with which Wilfred the Crusader was familiar, or fudge, in plain Saxon, and retired with a broken, gentle spirit, neither able to bear the sight of her rival's happiness, nor willing to disturb it by the contrast of her own wretchedness. Rowena, like the most high-bred and virtuous of women, never forgave Isaac's daughter her beauty, nor her flirtation with Wilfred, as the Saxon lady chose to term it, nor, above all, her admirable diamonds and jewels, although Rowena was actually in possession of them. In a word, she was always flinging Rebecca into Ivanhoe's teeth. There was not a day in his life, but that unhappy warrior was made to remember that a Hebrew damsel had been in love with him, and that a Christian lady of fashion could never forgive the insult. For instance, if Gurth, the swineherd, who was now promoted to be a gamekeeper and verderer, brought the account of a famous wild boar in the wood, and proposed a hunt, Rowena would say, do, Sir Wilfred, persecute these poor pigs. You know your friends the Jews can't abide them. Or when, as it oft would happen, our lion-hearted monarch, Richard, in order to get a loan, or a benevolence from the Jews, would roast a few of the Hebrew capitalists, or extract some of the principal rabbi's teeth, Rowena would exult and say, serve them right, the misbelieving wretches. England can never be a happy country until every one of these monsters is exterminated, or else, adopting a strain of still more savage sarcasm, would exclaim, Ivanhoe, my dear, more persecution for the Jews. Hadn't you better interfere, my love? His Majesty will do anything for you. And, you know, the Jews were always such favorites of yours, or words to that effect. But, nevertheless, her ladyship never lost an opportunity of wearing Rebecca's jewels at court, whenever the Queen held a drawing room, or at the York Assizes and Ball, when she appeared there. Not, of course, because she took any interest in such things, but because she considered it her duty to attend, as one of the chief ladies of the county. Thus Sir Wilfred of Ivanhoe, having attained the height of his wishes, was, like many a man, when he has reached that dangerous elevation, disappointed. Ah, dear friends, it is but too often so in life. Many a garden, seen from a distance, looks fresh and green, which, when beheld closely, is dismal and weedy, the shady walks melancholy and grass-grown, the bowers you would fain repose in, cushioned with stinging nettles. I have ridden in a cake upon the waters of the Bosphorus, and looked upon the capital of the Sultan of Turkey.
as seen from those blue waters, with palace and pinnacle, with gilded dome and towering cypress, it seemeth a very paradise of Mahound. But, enter the city, and it is but a beggarly labyrinth of rickety huts and dirty alleys, where the ways are steep, and the smells are foul, tenanted by mangy dogs and ragged beggars, a dismal illusion. Life is such, ah, well a day. It is only hope which is real, and reality is a bitterness and a deceit. Perhaps a man with Ivanhoe's high principles would never bring himself to acknowledge this fact, but others did for him. He grew thin, and pined away as much as if he had been in a fever under the scorching sun of Ascalon. He had no appetite for his meals. He slept ill, though he was yawning all day. The jangling of the doctors and friars whom Rowena brought together did not in the least enliven him, and he would sometimes give proofs of somnolency during their disputes, greatly to the consternation of his lady. He hunted a good deal, and, I very much fear, as Rowena rightly remarked, that he might have an excuse for being absent from home. He began to like wine too, who had been as sober as a hermit, and when he came back from Athelstan's, whither he would repair not unfrequently, the unsteadiness of his gait and the unnatural brilliancy of his eye were remarked by his lady, who, you may be sure, was sitting up for him. As for Athelstan, he swore by St. Wulstan that he was glad to have escaped a marriage with such a pattern of propriety, and honest Cedric the Saxon, who had been very speedily driven out of his daughter-in-law's castle, vowed by St. Wulfheof that his son had bought a dear bargain. So Sir Wilfred of Ivanhoe became almost as tired of England as his royal master Richard was, who always quitted the country when he had squeezed from his loyal nobles, commons, clergy, and Jews, all the money which he could get, and when the lion-hearted prince began to make war against the French king, in Normandy and Guyenne, Sir Wilfred pined like a true servant, to be in company of the good champion, alongside of whom he had shivered so many lances, and dealt such woundy blows of sword and battle-axe on the plains of Jaffa or the breaches of Acre. Travelers were welcome at Rotherwood, that brought news from the camp of the good king. And I warrant me, that the knight listened with all his might when Father Drono, the chaplain, read in the St. James Chronicle, which was the paper of news he of Ivanhoe took in, of another glorious triumph, effiate of the French near Blois, splendid victory at Ept, and narrow escape of the French king, the which deeds of arms the learned scribes had to narrate. However such tales might excite him during the reading, they left the knight of Ivanhoe only the more melancholy after listening, and the more moody as he sat in his great hall silently draining his Gascony wine. Silently sat he and looked at his coats of mail hanging vacant on the wall, his banner covered with spider webs, and his sword and axe rusting there. H. Dear axe, sighed he into his drinking horn, H. Gentle steel. That was a merry time, when I sent thee crashing into the pate of the Emir Abdelmelik as he rode on the right of Saladin. Ah, my sword, my dainty headsman, my sweet split rib, my razor of infidel beards. Is the rust to eat thine edge off, and am I never more to wield thee in battle? What is the use of a shield on a wall, or a lance, that has a cobweb for a pennon? O Richard, my good king, would I could hear once more thy voice in the front of the onset. Bones of Brian the Templar? Would ye could rise from your grave at Templestowe, and that we might break another spear for honor, and Rebecca, he would have said. But the knight paused here in rather a guilty panic. And her royal highness the Princess Rowena, as she chose to style herself at home, looked so hard at him out of her china blue eyes, that Sir Wilfred felt as if she was reading his thoughts, and was fain to drop his own eyes into his flagon. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.